This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents The Secrets She Keeps, a novel. Written by Michael Robotham. Read by Lucy Price Lewis. Part 1. Agatha. I am not the most important person in this story. That honour belongs to Meg, who's married to Jack, and they are the perfect parents of two perfect children, a boy and girl, blonde and blue-eyed, and sweeter than honey cakes. Meg is pregnant again, and I couldn't be more excited because I'm having a baby too. Leaning my forehead against the glass, I look in both directions along the pavement, past the greengrocer and hairdressing salon and fashion boutique. Meg's running late. Normally she's dropped Lucy at primary school, and Lachlan at his day nursery by now, and has joined her friends at the cafe on the corner. Her mother's group meets every Friday morning, sitting at an outdoor table, jostling prams into place like prime movers on the vehicle deck of a ferry. One skinny cappuccino, one chai latte, and a pot of herbal tea. A red bus goes past and blocks my view of Barnes Green, which is opposite. When it pulls away again, I see Meg on the far side of the road. She's dressed in her stretched jeans and a baggy sweater, and carrying a colourful three-wheeled scooter. Lachlan must have insisted on riding to his preschool, which would have slowed her down. He'll also have stopped to look at the ducks, and at the exercise class, and at the old people doing Tai Chi, who move so slowly they could almost be stop-motion puppets. Meg doesn't appear pregnant from this angle. It's only when she turns side-on that the bump becomes a basketball, neat and round, getting lower by the day. I heard her complaining last week about swollen ankles and a sore back. I know how she feels. My extra pounds have turned climbing stairs into a workout, and my bladder is the size of a walnut. Glancing both ways, she crosses Church Road and mouths the word "sorry" to her friends, double-kissing their cheeks and cooing at their babies. All babies are cute, people say, and I guess that's true. I have peered into prams at golem-like creatures with sticky-out eyes and two strands of hair, yet always found something to love, because they're so newly minted and innocent. I'm supposed to be stacking the shelves in aisle 3. This part of the supermarket is usually a safe place to skive, because the manager, Mr. Patel, has a problem with feminine hygiene products. He won't use words like tampons or sanitary pads, calling them ladies' things, or simply pointing to the boxes that he wants unpacked. I work 4 days a week, early mornings to 3, unless one of the other part-timers calls in sick. Mostly I stack shelves and sticker prices. Mr. Patel won't let me work the cash register because he says I break things. That happened one time, and it wasn't my fault. With a name like Mr. Patel, I thought he'd be Pakistani or Indian, but he turned out to be Welsher than a daffodil, with a shock of red hair and a truncated moustache that makes him look like Adolf Hitler's ginger love child. Mr. Patel doesn't like me very much, and he's been itching to get rid of me ever since I told him I was pregnant.
Don't expect any maternity leave, you're not full-time.
I don't expect any.
And doctor's appointments are on your own time.
Sure.
And if you can't lift boxes, you'll have to stop working.
I can lift boxes. Mr. Patel has a wife and 4 kids at home, but it hasn't made him any more sympathetic to my pregnancy. I don't think he likes women very much. I don't mean he's gay. When I first started working at the supermarket, he was all over me like a rash, finding any excuse to brush up against me in the storeroom or when I was mopping the floor.
"Oops," he'd say, pressing his hard-on against my buttocks. "Just parking my bike.
Pervert." I go back to my stock trolley and pick up the price gun, careful to check the settings. Last week I put the wrong price on the canned peaches, and Mr. Patel docked me 8 quid.
"What are you doing?" barks a voice.
Mr. Patel has crept up behind me. "Restocking the tampons," I stutter.
"He was staring out the window," Your forehead made that greasy mark on the glass.
No, Mr. Patel.
Do I pay you to daydream?
No, sir. I point to the shelf. We're out of the Tampax Super Plus, the one with the applicator.
Mr. Patel looks queasy. Well, look in the storeroom.
He's backing away.
There's a spill in aisle two. Mop it up.
Yes, Mr. Patel.
Then you can go home.
But I'm working until three.
Devyani will cover for you. She can climb the step ladder.
What he means is that she's not pregnant or afraid of heights, and that she'll let him park his bike without going all feminist on his arse. I should sue him for sexual harassment, but I like this job. It gives me an excuse to be in Barnes and nearer to Meg. In the rear storeroom, I fill a bucket with hot, soapy water and choose a sponge mop that hasn't worn away to the metal frame. Aisle two is closer to the registers. I get a good view of the cafe and the outside tables. I take my time cleaning the floor, staying clear of Mr. Patel. Meg and her friends are finishing up. Cheeks are kissed, phones are checked, babies are strapped into prams and pushchairs. Meg makes some final remark and laughs, tossing her fair hair. Almost unconsciously, I toss mine. It doesn't work. That's the problem with curls. They don't toss, they bounce. Meg's hairdresser, Jonathan, warned me that I couldn't get away with the same cut that she does, but I wouldn't listen to him. Meg is standing outside the cafe, texting someone on her phone. It's probably Jack. They'll be discussing what to have for dinner, or making plans for the weekend. I like her maternity jeans. I need a pair like that. Something with an elasticated waist. I wonder where she bought them. Although I see Meg most days, I've only ever spoken to her once. She asked if we had any more bran flakes, but we'd sold out. I wish I could have said yes. I wish I could have gone back through the swinging plastic doors and returned with a box of bran flakes just for her. That was in early May. I suspected she was pregnant even then. A fortnight later, she picked up a pregnancy test from the pharmacy aisle, and my suspicions were confirmed. Now, we're both in our third trimester, with only 6 weeks to go, and Meg has become my role model, because she makes marriage and motherhood look so easy. For starters, she's drop-dead gorgeous. I bet she could easily have been a model, not the bulimic catwalk kind or the four page three stunner kind, but a wholesome and sexy girl-next-door type, the ones who advertise laundry detergent or home insurance and are always running across flowery meadows or along a beach with a Labrador. I'm none of the above. I'm not particularly pretty, nor am I plain. Unthreatening is probably the right word. I'm the less attractive friend that all pretty girls need, because I won't steal their limelight and will happily take their leftovers, food and boyfriends. One of the sad truths of retailing is that people don't notice shelf stackers. I'm like a vagrant sleeping in a doorway, or a beggar holding up a cardboard sign. Invisible. Occasionally someone will ask me a question, but they never look at my face when I'm answering. If there was a bomb scare at the supermarket and everyone was evacuated except me, the police would ask, "Did you see anyone else in the shop?" "No," they'd say. "What about the shelf stacker?" "Who?" "The person stacking the shelves." "I didn't take much notice of him." "It was a woman." "Really?" That's me. Unseen. Inappreciable. A shelf stacker. I glance outside. Meg's walking towards the supermarket. The automatic doors open. She picks up a plastic shopping basket and wanders along aisle one, fruit and veg. When she gets to the end, she'll turn and head this way. I follow her progress and catch a glimpse of her when she passes the pasta and canned tomatoes. She turns into my aisle. I push the bucket to one side and step back, wondering if I should nonchalantly lean on my mop or shoulder it like a wooden rifle. "Careful, the floor's wet," I say, sounding like I'm talking to a two-year-old. My voice surprises her. She mumbles thank you and slides by, her belly almost touching mine. "When are you due?" I ask. Meg stops and turns. "Early December." She notices that I'm pregnant. "How about you?" "The same." "What day?" she asks. "December 5th. "A boy or a girl?" "I don't know. How about you?" "A boy,"
She's carrying Lachlan's scooter. You already have one, I say.
Two,
she replies.
Wow.
I'm staring at her. I tell myself to look away. I glance at my feet, then the bucket, the condensed milk, and the custard powder. I should say something else. I can't think.
Meg's basket is heavy.
Well, good luck.
You too,
I say. She's gone, heading towards the checkout. Suddenly I think of all the things I could have said. I could have asked where she was having the baby, what sort of birth. I could have commented on her stretch jeans, asked her where she bought them.
Meg's joined the queue at the register, flicking through the gossip magazines as she waits her turn. The new Vogue isn't out, but she settles for Tatler and a copy of Private Eye. Mr. Patel begins scanning her items, eggs, milk, potatoes, mayonnaise, rocket and parmesan. You can tell a lot about a person from the contents of a shopping trolley. The vegetarians, vegans, alcoholics, chocoholics, Weight Watchers, Five Tours, cat lovers, dog owners, dope smokers, celiacs, the lactose intolerant, and those with dandruff, diabetes, vitamin deficiencies, constipation or ingrown toenails. That's how I know so much about Meg. I know she's a lapsed vegetarian who started eating red meat again when she fell pregnant, most likely because of the iron. She likes tomato-based sauces, fresh pasta, cottage cheese, dark chocolate, and those shortbread biscuits that come in tins. I've spoken to her properly now. We've made a connection. We're going to be friends, Meg and I, and I'll be just like her. I'll make a lovely home and keep my man happy. We'll do yoga classes and swap recipes and meet for coffee every Friday morning with our mother's group.
Megan. Another Friday. I'm counting them down, crossing them off the calendar, scratching tally marks on the wall. This pregnancy seems to be longer than my other two. It's almost as though my body has rebelled against the idea, demanding to know why it wasn't consulted. Last night I thought I was having a heart attack, but it was only heartburn. Chicken madras was a big mistake. I drank a whole bottle of Gaviscon, which tastes like liquid chalk and makes me burp like a trucker. This baby is going to come out looking like Andy Warhol. Now I need to pee. I should have gone at the cafe, but it didn't seem necessary then. My pelvic floor muscles are working overtime as I hurry across the park, cursing every time Lachlan's scooter bashes me in the shins.
Please don't pee. Please don't pee.
An exercise class has taken over one corner of the park. Elsewhere, there are personal trainers standing over clients, telling them to do one more push-up or sit-up. Maybe I'll get one of those when this is all over. Jack has started making cracks about my size. He knows I'm bigger this time because I didn't lose my baby weight after Lachlan. I shouldn't be made to feel guilty. Pregnant women should be able to eat chocolate and wear sensible pajamas and make love with the lights off. Not that there's much of that nowadays. Jack hasn't touched me in weeks. I think he has this strange aversion to sleeping with a woman who is carrying his child, viewing me as some sort of virginal Madonna figure who can't be soiled.
It's not because you're fat, he said the other night.
I'm not fat. I'm pregnant. Of course, that's what I meant. I called him a bastard. He referred to me as Megan. He does that when we're having an argument. I hate the long form of my name. I like Meg because it reminds me of nutmeg, an exotic spice that men and countries have fought wars over. Jack and I have skirmishes rather than battles. We're like Cold War diplomats who say nice things to each other while secretly stockpiling ammunition. When do couples run out of things to say, I wonder? When does the passion wane? When do the conversations become dull-witted and boring? When do iPhones make it to the dinner table? When do mothers' groups graduate from talking about their babies to bitching about their husbands? When does the house training of a man become proof of love? When does the gap between every woman's dream husband and every man's dream wife become a journey from pole to pole?
Ooh, this stuff is good,
I should be writing it down for my blog.
No, I can't do that. When I married Jack, I promised I wouldn't be one of those wives who tried to change him into something he wasn't. I fell in love with him, as is, off the peg, straight out of the box, no customizing necessary. I am happy with my choices, and refuse to waste time contemplating alternative lives. Our marriage isn't so bad. It's a partnership, a meeting of minds and kindred spirits. Only up close do the flaws become apparent, like a delicate vase that has been dropped and pasted back together. Nobody else seems to notice, but I nurse that vase in my mind, hoping it still holds water, telling myself that midlife humps are like speed bumps that make us slow down and smell the roses. Jack and I didn't plan to have another child. This one is our oops baby. Accidental, unscripted, but not unwanted. Not by me, anyway. We took a rare weekend away for a friend's 40th birthday party. My mother offered to look after Lucy and Lachlan. Jack and I drank too much, danced, fell into bed, made love in the morning. Jack had forgotten the condoms. We took a chance. Why wouldn't we, when you consider the number of times we'd risked a quick shag, only to be interrupted mid-coitus by,
"Mummy, I'm thirsty,"
or,
"Mummy, I can't find Bunny,"
or,
"Mummy, I've wet the bed."
My other pregnancies were arranged like military campaigns, but this one was literally a shot in the dark. "If it's a girl, we should call her Roulette," Jack said when the shock wore off.
"We're not calling her Roulette."
"Okay." These jokes came after the arguments and the recriminations, which have stopped now, but are likely to resurface when Jack is angry or stressed. He's a sports reporter for one of the cable channels, doing live football feeds from Premier League games and a full-time wrap-up of the goals and scorers. During the summer, he covers a mixture of sports, including the Tour de France, but never Wimbledon or the Open. His star is on the rise, meaning bigger games, more airtime, and a higher profile. Jack loves being recognized. Normally it's by people who have some vague notion they've met him before.
"Aren't you someone?"
they ask when they interrupt our conversation, gushing over Jack and ignoring me. I look at the back of their heads and want to say, "Hello, I'm chopped liver." Instead, I smile and let them have their moment. Jack apologizes afterwards. I love that he's ambitious and successful, but sometimes wish he'd give us more of the public Jack the lad, rather than the stressed version who comes home late or leaves early. "Maybe if you went back to work," he said last night, which is another sore point. Jack resents me not having a job. His words, not mine. "Who would look after the children?" I asked. "Other women go to work. They have nannies or au pairs. Lucy's at school and Lachlan is in childcare. Half days. And now you're pregnant again." These arguments cover the same old ground as we lob grenades from opposite trenches. "I have my blog," I say.
"What good's that?"
"It earned £200 last month."
"168, he replied. "I do the accounts."
"Look at all the free stuff I get sent. Clothes, baby food, nappies. That new pram is top of the range."
"We wouldn't need a new pram if you weren't pregnant."
I rolled my eyes and tried a different tack. "If I went back to work, we'd spend my entire wage on childcare. And unlike you, Jack, I don't clock in and clock out. When was the last time you woke up for a nightmare or to do the water run?"
"You're right," he said sarcastically. "That's because I get up and go to work, so I pay for this lovely house and our two cars and those clothes in your wardrobe, and the holidays, school fees, gym membership."
I should have kept my mouth shut. Jack belittles my blog, Mucky Kids, but I have over 6,000 followers, and last month a parenting magazine called it one of the best 5 mummy blogs in Britain. I should have hit Jack with that fact, but by then he'd gone to have a shower. He came downstairs wearing nothing but his short dressing gown, which always makes me laugh. After apologizing, he offered to rub my feet. I arched an eyebrow. "What are you going to rub them on?"
We settled for a cup of tea in the kitchen and began discussing getting a nanny, trotting out the same cases for and against. I love the idea in theory, the me time, added sleep and extra energy for sex. But then I picture a tight-bodied Polish girl bending over to fill the dishwasher, or wrapped in a loosely tied towel as she leaves the bathroom. Am I paranoid? Maybe. Sensible? Absolutely. I met Jack at the Beijing Olympics. I had a job in the media center looking after the accredited journalists. Jack was working for Eurosport. He was still quite junior, learning the ropes, watching how it was done. Both of us were too busy in Beijing to notice each other. But when it was over, the host broadcaster threw a party for all the affiliated media. By then I knew a lot of the journalists, some of whom were quite famous, but most were boring, always talking shop. Jack seemed different. He was funny, cool, sexy. I liked everything about him, including his name, which made him seem like a regular Tom, Dick or Harry. He also had a great smile and film star hair. I watched him from across the room and made the mistake of plotting our entire relationship in the course of 60 seconds. I had us marrying in London, honeymooning in Barbados, and having at least 4 children, a dog, a cat, and a big house in Richmond. The party was winding down. I thought of something clever to say and made my way through the crowd. But before I could reach Jack, he was waylaid by a female reporter from Sky Italia. Big hair, voluptuous, faces close, shouting to be heard. 20 minutes later I watched him walk off with the Italian job, and I immediately felt cheated upon. I found a dozen reasons why I didn't like Jack. He was cocky, he put highlights in his hair, he whitened his teeth. I told myself that he wasn't my type because I didn't go for pretty men. This might not have been a conscious choice. Pretty men didn't usually go for me. It was 2 years before we met again. The International Olympic Committee held a reception for delegates who were in London to inspect venues for the 2012 Games. I saw Jack arguing with a woman in the hotel foyer. He was animated and adamant about something. She was crying. Later, I saw him alone at the bar, drinking the free booze and hijacking plates of canapés from passing waiters. I pushed my way between bodies and said hello, smiled. Was it wrong to catch him on the rebound? We chatted, laughed, drank. I tried hard not to try too hard.
I need some fresh air,
Jack said, almost falling off the stool.
Fancy a walk?
Sure. It was nice to be outside, walking in step, leaning close. He knew a coffee place in Covent Garden that stayed open till late. We talked until they threw us out. Jack escorted me home and walked me to my front door.
Will you go out with me?
He asked. On a date?
Is that okay?
Sure.
How about breakfast?
It's 2:30 in the morning.
Brunch, then?
Are you angling to spend the night?
No, I just want to make sure I see you tomorrow.
You mean today?
Yes.
We could do lunch.
I don't know if I can wait that long.
You're sounding needy.
I am.
Why did you fight with that woman I saw you with?
She broke up with me.
Why?
She said I was too ambitious.
Are you?
Yes.
Is that it?
She also said I killed her fish.
Her fish?
She keeps tropical fish. I was supposed to be looking after them, and I accidentally turned off the water heater.
When you were living with her?
We weren't exactly living together. I had a drawer. It's where she kept my balls.
She was crying.
She's a good actress.
Did you love her?
No.
Are you always like this? Like what?
Interrogating.
I'm interested.
He laughed.
Our first proper date was a lunch at Covent Garden, close to where we both worked. He took me to the Opera Terrace. Afterwards, we watched the street performers and buskers and living statues. Jack was easy company, curious and attentive. One good story led to another. We went out again the next evening and shared a cab home. It was past midnight. We both had to work the next day. Jack didn't ask to come inside, but I took his hand and led him up the stairs. I fell in love. Madly, deeply, hopelessly. It should happen to everyone once, even if love should never be hopeless. I adored everything about Jack, his smile, his laugh, his looks, the way he kissed. He was like an everlasting packet of chocolate biscuits. I knew that I'd eat too many and make myself sick, but I ate them anyway. 6 months later, we were married. Jack's career blossomed, then stalled for a while. But now it's moving again. I fell pregnant with Lucy and turned down a promotion that would have taken me to New York. Lachlan arrived 2 years later, and I left my job to become a stay-at-home mum. My parents helped us buy the house in Barnes. I wanted to go further south and have a smaller mortgage. Jack wanted the postcode as well as the lifestyle. So here we are, the perfect nuclear family, with an oops baby on the way, and the doubts and arguments of the middle years starting to surface. I love my children. I love my husband. Yet sometimes I rake my memory to find moments that make me truly happy. The man I fell in love with, the one who said that he loved me first, has changed. The happy-go-lucky, easy-going Jack has turned into a brittle man, whose emotions are wrapped so tightly in barbed wire that I cannot hope to unloop them. I'm not focusing on his failings or tallying his shortcomings. I still love him. I do. I only wish he wouldn't fixate so much on himself, or question why our family isn't more like the Disney Channel variety, where everyone is happy, healthy, witty, and there are unicorns tethered in the garden. Agatha. My shift finishes, and I get changed in the stockroom, rolling my smock and name tag into a ball and shoving them behind the tins of olive oil and cans of tomatoes. Mr. Patel expects employees to take their uniforms home, but I'm not doing his laundry. Shrugging on my winter coat, I slip out the rear door, skirting the rubbish bins and discarded cardboard boxes. Pulling my hood over my head, I imagine I look like Meryl Streep in The French Lieutenant's Woman. She was a whore, abandoned by a French ship's officer who spent her life staring out to sea, waiting for him to return. My sailor is coming home to me, and I'm giving him a baby. On the eastern edge of Putney Common, I catch the number 22 double-decker bus along Lower Richmond Road to Putney Bridge. In the early part of my pregnancy, people weren't sure whether to congratulate me or buy me a gym membership, but now I get offered seats on buses and crowded trains. I love being pregnant, feeling my baby inside me, stretching, yawning, hiccuping and kicking. It's like I'm never alone anymore. I have someone to keep me company and listen to my stories. A businessman sits opposite me, dressed in a suit and tie. He's in his mid-40s, with hair the colour of mushroom soup. I notice how his eyes travel over my baby bump. He smiles, finding me attractive. Fertile. Fecund. Isn't that a good word? I only learned it the other day. Fecund. You have to put the accent on the un sound and punch out the D. Mr. Businessman is checking out my rock star cleavage. I wonder if I could seduce him. Some men get off on sleeping with pregnant women. I could take him home, tie him down and say, let me do the touching. I'd never do it, of course, but Hayden has been away for 7 months, and a girl has needs. My sailor boy is a communications technician in the Royal Navy, although I don't really know what that means. It's something to do with computers and intelligence and briefing senior officers, which sounded very important when Hayden tried to explain it to me. Right now he's on HMS Sutherland, chasing Somali pirates somewhere in the Indian Ocean. It's an 8-month deployment, and he won't be home until Christmas. We met last New Year's Eve at a nightclub in Soho. Hot and noisy with overpriced drinks and strobing lights, I was ready to go home well before midnight. Most of the guys were drunk, checking out the teenage girls in their crotch-defying dresses and fuck-me heels. I feel sorry for hookers these days. How do they stand out anymore? Occasionally, some guy would summon up enough courage to ask a girl to dance, only to be dismissed with a flick of her hair or the curl of a painted lip. I was different. I said hello. I showed interest, I let Hayden press his body against me and yell into my ear. We kissed. He grabbed my arse. He assumed he was sorted. I was probably the oldest woman in the club, but a hell of a lot classier than the rest of them. Admittedly, gravity has made some inroads on my arse, but I have a nice face when I paint it properly, and I can hide my muffin top with the right clothes. All importantly, I have great boobs. Have done since I was 11 or 12 when I first noticed people staring at my bust. Men, boys, husbands, teachers and family friends. I ignored them at first, my boobs, I mean. Later, I tried to diet them away and strap them down, but they wouldn't be squashed or flattened or hidden away. Hayden is a boob man. I could tell from the first time he set eyes on me, or them. Men are so obvious. I could see him thinking, are they natural? You bet they are, Buster. At first, I thought he might be too young for me. He still had pimples on his chin and looked a little scrawny. But he had lovely, dark, wavy hair, which I always think is wasted on a boy. I brought him home, and he shagged me like a man who thought he might not get laid for another 8 months, which was probably right, although I don't know what sailors get up to on shore leave. Like a lot of my boyfriends, he preferred me on top, so my boobs hung down around his face, while I bucked and moaned. Afterwards, I cleaned myself up in the bathroom and half expected Hayden to get dressed and leave. Instead, he snuggled deep under the covers and wrapped his arms around me. In the morning, he was still there. I cooked him breakfast. We went back to bed. We had lunch and went back to bed. That was pretty much the story for the next 2 weeks. Eventually, we ventured out, and he treated me like his girlfriend. On our first proper date, he took me to the National Maritime Museum in Greenwich. We caught the river bus from Bankside Pier, and Hayden pointed out landmarks along the way, like HMS Belfast, a museum ship near Tower Bridge. Hayden knew the whole history, how she'd been damaged by a German mine in World War II and later took part in the Normandy landings. At the Maritime Museum, he continued my education, telling me about Lord Nelson and his battles against Napoleon. One particular painting caught my eye, called Tahiti Revisited. It showed an island in the South Pacific, with rocky peaks, lush forests, palm trees, and voluptuous women bathing in a river. As I stared at the scene, I could feel the warmth of the sand between my toes, and smell the frangipani blossoms, and feel the salt water drying on my skin. "Have you ever been to Tahiti?" I asked Hayden. "Not yet," he said, "but I'll go one day. Will you take me?" He laughed and said that I looked seasick on the river bus. On another day, we went to the Imperial War Museum in South London, and I learned that more than 50,000 sailors died in World War II. It made me frightened for Hayden, but he said the last British warship to be lost at sea was the HMS Coventry during the Falklands War, which was before Hayden was even born. We had 3 months together before Hayden had to rejoin his ship. I know that doesn't seem like long, but I felt married during that time, like I was part of something bigger than both of us. I know that he loves me, he told me so, and even though he's 9 years younger than me, he's old enough to settle down. We're good together. I make him laugh, and the sex is great. Hayden doesn't know that I'm pregnant. The silly boy thinks we broke up before he left. He caught me going through his emails and text messages and completely overreacted, calling me paranoid and crazy. Things were said that I'm sure both of us regret. Hayden stormed out of my flat and didn't come back until after midnight, drunk. I pretended to be asleep. He fumbled with his clothes, pulling off his jeans, falling on his arse. I could tell he was still angry. In the morning I let him sleep and went out to the shops to buy bacon and eggs for breakfast. I left him a note, love, kisses. When I returned, he was already gone. My note was screwed up on the floor. I tried to call him. He didn't answer. I went to the bus stop and to the train station, but I knew he'd gone. I left messages saying I was sorry, begging him to call me. But he hasn't answered any of my emails or texts, and he unfriended me on Facebook. Hayden doesn't realize that I was trying to protect us. I know lots of women who will happily steal someone's boyfriend or husband. You take his ex, Bronte Flynn, a right slag, notorious for doing a Britney, going commando. Hayden still follows her on Facebook and Instagram, posting comments on her slutty selfies. She's the reason I looked at his phone, out of love, not jealousy. Anyway, we're pregnant now, and I don't want to break the news to Hayden in an email. It has to be face to face. But that can't happen unless he agrees to talk to me. Navy personnel are allowed 20 minutes of satellite calls a week when they're away at sea, but recipients must be on a list. Hayden needs to nominate me as his girlfriend or partner and give the Navy my number. Last week, I talked to the RN welfare office and told them I was pregnant. A nice woman took down my details and was very sympathetic. They'll make Hayden call me now. The captain will give him a direct order. That's why I've been home every evening, waiting by the phone.
Megan. My father is turning 65 and retiring this month after 42 years with the same finance company. Tonight is his birthday dinner and Jack's running late. He promised to be home at 5:30 and it's after 6. I won't call him because he'll accuse me of nagging. He finally arrives and blames the traffic. We have an argument in the car, conducted in whispers, while Lucy and Lachlan are strapped in their seats, listening to the soundtrack from Frozen. Jack accelerates through a changing light. You're driving too fast. You said we were late. So now you're going to kill us? Don't be ridiculous. You should have left earlier. You're right. I should have come home at midday. We could have painted our nails together. Fuck you! The words just slip out. Lucy's head shoots up. Jack gives me a look that says, really? In front of the children?
You said a bad word, says Lucy.
No, I didn't. I said duck soup. We might be having that for dinner. She screws up her face.
I don't like duck soup. It's yucky, says Lachlan,
who shouts rather than talks. You've never had it before.
Yucky yuck, duck soup,
he sings even louder. Okay, we'll have something else, I say. We drive in silence, edging through traffic towards Chiswick Bridge. Quietly fuming, I think of all the meals that have been spoiled by Jack turning up late. I hate him when he derides and belittles what I do. We reach my parents' house at 7. The kids run inside. You can be such a shit sometimes, I say as I grab the salads, and Jack picks up the travelling cot. My sister comes out to help. Grace is 6 years younger than me, happily single but always accompanied by an attractive, successful man who seems to worship the ground she walks upon, even when she's walking all over him. How's Daddy? I ask. Holding court, we hug. He's fired up the barbecue. We're going to be eating charred sausages and kebabs again. Grace and I don't exactly look like sisters. I'm prettier, but she has more personality, I've heard people say, which I thought was a compliment when I was 14, but now I know differently. Jack sets up the travelling cot in one of the spare bedrooms, before joining the men in the garden, where they're standing around the barbecue, that great leveller of legends, where any man can be king if he's holding the tongs. His first two beers go down in a matter of minutes. He gets a third. When did I start counting? Mum needs help in the kitchen. We dress the salads and butter the potatoes. Grace is playing with Lucy and Lachlan, keeping them amused until dinner. She says she loves kids, but I suspect that's only other people's children who can be handed back when they're overtired or emotional. I hear laughter outside. Jack has cracked everyone up with one of his stories. They love him. He's the life and soul of every party. The TV star who is full of gossip about transfers and signings. A lot of guys are knowledgeable about football, but they all defer to Jack on the subject because they imagine he has some added insight or inside knowledge.
You're lucky with that one, my mother says.
Pardon?
Jack.
I smile and nod, still looking into the garden where flames are leaping from the barbecue.
I have no idea what I'm going to do with him,
says my mother, referring to Daddy's retirement.
He has plans. Golf and gardening. He'll be bored silly within a month.
You could always travel,
He keeps wanting to go back to places we've been before. They're like pilgrimages.
She reminds me of when they went back to the hotel in Greece where they spent their honeymoon. They were woken at 3 in the morning by a Russian waving money around and demanding sex.
The place had become a brothel.
Sounds like an adventure, I say.
I'm too old for that kind of adventure.
When the meat is suitably cremated, we sit down to eat. Lachlan and Lucy have their own little table, but I finish up sitting with them, coaxing food into Lucy and stopping Lachlan from drowning his sausage in ketchup. There are toasts and speeches. Daddy gets maudlin and thick-voiced when he talks about how much his family means to him. Jack keeps making wisecracks, but it's not the time or the place. At 10 o'clock, we each carry a sleeping child to the car and make our farewells. I drive. Jack dozes. I wake him at home and we repeat the kid shuffle, carrying each to their beds. I'm exhausted, and it's not even 11. Jack wants a nightcap. Haven't you had enough? I say, wanting to reclaim the words as soon as they come out.
What did you say?
Nothing.
No, I heard you.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean it.
Yes, you did.
Let's not fight. I'm tired.
You're always tired.
Too tired for sex is what he means.
I wanted to have sex all week, but you weren't interested, I counter, which technically isn't true.
Can you blame me? Asks Jack.
What does that mean?
He doesn't answer, but I know he's saying that he doesn't find me attractive right now, and that he didn't want another baby. 2 is enough, a boy and a girl, all bases covered.
I didn't do it on purpose, I say. It was an accident.
And you decided to keep it?
We agreed.
No, you decided.
Really? Is that what you tell your mates at the pub? That you're so pussy-whipped that I bully you into having children?
Jack's fist tightens on his glass and his eyes shut, as though he's counting to 10. He takes his drink into the garden and lights a cigarette from the packet he keeps on a high shelf beside the kitchen clock. He knows I hate him smoking. He also knows I won't complain. Our fights are like this. We snipe rather than throw plates. We go for those tender spots, the weaknesses and embarrassments that we have learned how to find in the course of a marriage. Once, we made a point of never going to sleep angry at each other. I don't know when that changed. I keep telling myself that everything will be fine when the baby is born. I'll have more energy. His doubts will disappear. We'll be happy again.
Agatha.
Sometimes I feel as though my past ticks inside me, like a phantom clock, telling me what dates must be acknowledged and what sins need to be atoned for. Today is such a date. 1st of November. An anniversary of sorts, which is why I'm travelling north under a bleak grey sky on a National Express coach that hugs the inner lane of the motorway. Rolling my forehead against the glass, I watch cars and trucks overtake, their wheels spitting water and wipers swaying back and forth. The rain seems particularly apt. My childhood memories do not involve endless summers, long twilights and crickets chirruping in the grass. The Leeds of my youth was eternally grey, cold and drizzling. My family home is gone, bulldozed to make way for a bulk goods warehouse. My mother bought again, a small terrace not far from our old house, using money my stepfather left her. He died on a golf course, having sliced his drive into a pond. A heart attack. Who knew he had one? My mother rang to tell me the news, asking if I would come to the funeral, but I told her I'd rather gloat from a distance. I won't be seeing my mother today. She's wintering in Spain, as she likes to call it, which means roasting like a chicken beside a swimming pool in Marbella, drinking sangria and being rude about the locals. She's not rich, simply racist. From Leeds coach station, I head to the nearest florist and have her make 3 small crowns of baby's breath and greenery. She wraps them in tissue paper and puts them in a polished paper box that I tuck into my shoulder bag. Afterwards, I buy myself a sandwich and drink before catching a minicab along the A65 as far as Kirkstall,
where it crosses the River Aire. The minicab drops me near Broadley Hill, where I climb over a stile and follow a muddy path through the forest. I can name most of the trees and shrubs, as well as the birds, thanks to Nicky, my ex-husband. He thought I wasn't listening when he pointed things out to me, but I loved hearing his stories and marvelling at how much he knew. I met Nicky a month after my 30th birthday, just when I thought time was running out to meet Mr. Right, or Mr. Wrong, or any old mister. Most of my friends were married or engaged or in long-term relationships by then. Some were pregnant for the second or third time, wanting big families or more welfare, or not planning at all. Living in London, I worked for a temp agency, doing short-term secretarial placements, mainly for women on maternity leave. I had a bedsit in Camden over a kebab shop that served up fights and doner kebabs when the pub shut their doors at night. It was Halloween. Gangs of witches, goblins and ghosts knocking on my door, holding out sacks and baskets. Having made another donation to British Dentistry, I found myself standing barefoot in the kitchen, feeling like a container of milk that had been left for too long in the fridge. My laptop was open on the kitchen table. On either side were piles of typewritten pages. For 3 months I'd been transcribing tapes for a writer called Nicholas David Feifel, who penned biographies of famous soldiers and war histories. He would courier me tapes and I would send back the transcripts. Our only other contact came via the quirky notes he wrote in the margins if he wanted me to retype certain sections. I wondered if he was flirting with me. I wondered what he looked like. I pictured a quiet, tortured artist creating beautiful prose in his garret, or a wild-haired, hard-drinking war correspondent living life on the edge. I only knew him from his notes and his voice on the tapes, which sounded gentle and kind, with a slight stutter at certain syllables and a nervous laugh when he lost his place. I made a decision. Instead of posting the transcripts, I delivered them by hand, knocking on the door of his house in Highgate. Nicky looked surprised, but also pleased. He invited me inside and made tea. He wasn't as handsome as I'd hoped, but he had a nice enough face and a skinny body that seemed to be growing into his clothes. I asked him about his books. He showed me his library.
Do you read?
I used to read a lot when I was little, I said. Nowadays I struggle to choose.
What sort of stories do you like?
I like happy endings.
We all like those,
he laughed. I suggested I transcribe the tapes at his house to save on the cost of couriers and speed up the process. I would arrive every day at 9 a.m. and work in his dining room, breaking occasionally to make us tea or microwave something to eat. It took weeks of flirting before Nicky kissed me. He was a virgin, I think. Tender and considerate, attentive but not skillful. I wanted him to moan or cry out when we made love, but he was always silent. Around his friends he acted like a typical lad, enjoying a pint and a punt on the horses. But with me, he was different. He took me on long walks in the countryside, investigating ruined castles and spotting woodland birds. Nicky proposed to me on one of our expeditions, and I said yes.
"When am I going to meet your parents?" he asked.
"You're not."
"But they'll come to the wedding, won't they?"
"No."
"They're your parents."
"I don't care. We'll have plenty of other guests." Even after we were married, Nicky kept trying to negotiate a reconciliation.
"You can't just stop speaking to them," he said.
But I could, and I did. It was like any relationship. If both parties cease to make an effort, it will wither and die. The ground slopes gently away from me as I follow a riding path dotted with puddles. Periodically I look over my shoulder, but nobody's following. My pregnancy is hidden beneath an overcoat, but I can feel the weight of the baby in my hip joints and the pressure in my pelvis. Clumsily, I climb an embankment using saplings as handholds. Twigs and dead leaves snap and crumble beneath my boots. I come to a ditch and jump across with all the grace of a leaping hippo. The sun has steadily strengthened, and I'm warmer now, sweating beneath the coat. Following a zigzagging track, I reach a clump of trees next to the ruins of a farmhouse. I hear water falling into a deep pond at the base of a weir that is further down the slope. Kneeling on the damp earth, I clear away vines and weeds, pulling out clumps of vegetation and clods of earth. Slowly, I reveal 3 small pyramids of stones, spaced at equal intervals around the clearing. When I'm satisfied, I take off my coat and lay it on the ground as a makeshift picnic blanket, leaning my back against the crumbling wall of the farmhouse. I found this place long before I met Nikki. I must have been 11 or 12 when I rode my bicycle along the towpath, past Kirkstall Abbey and the forge towards Horsforth. Pedalling in my cotton dress and sandals, I remember waving at the canal boats being manoeuvred through the locks. As I turned a corner, I glimpsed the remains of a chimney just visible through the trees. Fighting my way through brambles and vines, I found the ruined farmhouse, which felt almost enchanted, like a fairy tale castle that had been put to sleep 1,000 years ago. Much later I brought Nicky here, and he fell in love with it too. I said we should buy the land and rebuild the house. He could write and we'd have lots of children. Nicky laughed and told me to hold my horses, but I was already trying to get pregnant. Unprotected sex was like buying a scratch lotto card every 28 days, waiting to win a prize. I won nothing. We visited doctors and fertility clinics and alternative healers. I tried hormone injections, vitamins, drugs, acupuncture, hypnotherapy, Chinese herbs and special diets. IVF was the obvious step. We tried 4 times, using up our savings, and each failure became another heartbreak. A marriage of hope had turned to desperation. Nikki didn't want to try again, but did it for me. On our last throw of the dice, 1 embryo clung to my womb, like a limpet on a rocky shore. Nikki called it our miracle baby. I worried every day, because I didn't believe in miracles. Weeks passed, months. I grew bigger. We dared to choose names, Chloe for a girl and Jacob for a boy. I was 32 weeks when I stopped feeling the baby moving. I went straight to the hospital. One of the midwives hooked me up to a machine and couldn't find a heartbeat. She said it was probably just in a weird spot, but I knew something was wrong. A doctor came. He did another ultrasound and couldn't find any blood flow or heartbeat. "I had a dead baby inside me," he said. "Not a life. A corpse." Nikki and I cried for the longest time, grieving together. Later that day, they induced the birth. I went through the pain and the pushing, but there were no baby cries, no joy. Handed a bundle, I stared into the eyes of a still warm baby girl who hadn't lived long enough to take a breath or grow into her name. This is where we brought her ashes, Nikki and I, burying Chloe beside the crumbling farmhouse above the weir. Our special place. We promised to come back here every year on Chloe's birthday, which is today. But Nicky could never bring himself to visit. He told me we had to move forward, which is a term that I've never understood. The planet turns, time passes. We move forward even when we're standing still. Our marriage didn't survive the fallout. Within a year we'd separated, my fault, not his. My love for a child will be greater than my love for an adult, because it is a singular love that isn't based on physical attraction or shared experiences, or the pleasures of intimacy, or time together. It is unconditional, immeasurable, unshakable. The divorce was simple and clean. 5 years of marriage ended with the stroke of a pen. Nikki moved away from London. Last I heard, he was living with a schoolteacher in Newcastle, a divorcee with 2 teenage boys, an instant family, just add water and stir. Taking out the roast beef sandwich and a soft drink, I open the plastic triangle and eat slowly, collecting the crumbs in my cupped hand. A robin hops between the spindly branches of a shrub and perches on the top of Chloe's cairn, pivoting from side to side. I toss the crumbs onto the grass. The robin jumps down and pecks at my offering, occasionally cocking his head to look at me. Today is Chloe's birthday, but I mourn all of my babies. The ones I've lost and the ones I couldn't save. I mourn them because somebody must take responsibility. Before I leave the clearing, I unzip my backpack and take out the small floral crowns, trying not to crush the petals, and place one on each of the cairns, saying their names. I am having another baby, I tell them, but that doesn't mean I will love you less. Megan. I've been painting the baby's room and putting stencils on the walls. I'm not very adventurous when it comes to home decorating. I blame my parents, who didn't believe in allowing children freedom of expression. Trees had to be green and roses red. I'm also trying to keep one eye on Lachlan, who has already put handprints on the door and put a paintbrush in the wrong tin. It's all good material for my blog, I think, as I clean his hands in the laundry sink. Lachlan isn't exactly thrilled about me having another baby. It's not about sibling rivalry or being usurped as the youngest. He wants someone his own age to play with, either that or a puppy.
Why can't the baby be four, like me?
Because he wouldn't fit inside my tummy, I explain.
Can't you shrink him?
Not really.
You could grow bigger.
I think Mummy's big enough.
Daddy says you're fat.
He's only teasing, the arsehole. Speaking of Jack, he phoned earlier, saying that he'd be home tonight instead of taking the train to Manchester. He sounded in a good mood. For months he's been fleshing out ideas for a new TV show where big-name stars discuss the hot-button issues in sport. Jack wants to be the anchor. He's written a pitch, but is waiting for the right time to approach the powers that be.
Make sure you stay up, he said.
Why?
I have news.
I decide to make us something nice for dinner. Steak, new potatoes, and an endive salad. Typical French. I'll even open a bottle of red wine and let it breathe. I've been rather lazy in the kitchen since I fell pregnant. I couldn't even think of food for the first trimester. I go upstairs and shower, catching a glimpse of myself in the mirror. Turning side on, I examine my butt and boobs, ignoring the stretch marks. Leaning towards the mirror, I notice a strange curly hair corkscrewing out of my left temple. I look more closely. Oh, my God, I have a grey hair. I take a pair of tweezers and pull out the alien strand, examining it, hoping it might be paint. No, it's definitely grey. Another indignity. I pen a blog piece. I found a grey hair today and freaked out a little. This particular hair was devoid of colour and wiry near the tip. I've always been kind of smug about the fact that I didn't have any silver, yet, when others I know have been plucking and dying since they were 21. Now the ravages of time are beginning to show. What next? Wrinkles? Varicose veins? Menopause? I refuse to panic. I have friends my age who are living in complete denial, refusing to contemplate turning 40, telling everyone, "Nothing to see here, move along." I used to laugh at them, but now I have a grey hair. I want to put it down to the stress of pregnancy, but according to Google, there is no evidence that stress causes grey hair, nor does trauma or spending too long in the sun. The good news is that I can pluck it out without fear of three more growing in its place. The bad news is that I now have roughly 10 years before grey becomes my natural colour. Yeah, right. Over my dead body. When I've posted the piece, I begin reading some of the recent comments. Most of them are nice and supportive, but occasionally I get trolled by people who don't like my mindless babbling, or tell me to get off my mummy high horse. I've been called a skank, a whore, a whinger, and a slut. Worse still, I'm a bad mother for putting Lachlan into childcare, and I'm guilty of lording it over women who can't have children, and I'm personally responsible for global overpopulation because I'm having a third child. Last week, someone wrote, "I love the sound you make when you shut the fuck up." Another said, Your husband must like waking up with fleas. I delete the abusive comments, but I don't touch the negative.